1973 was a great year. Well, maybe not for Richard Nixon. But there was American Graffiti, Day for Night, and The Exorcist at the movies. George Steinbrenner bought the Yankees. More people watched Elvis in concert from Hawaii than had watched the moon landing. The Watergate scandal unfolded, and David Bowie sang about life on Mars. Take a look at the
is there life on Mars?
Which is also the song that sets off what's now considered a classic sci-fi British TV show, in which Manchester Chief Inspector Sam Tyler gets hit by a car in 2006 and wakes up in a world where everybody smokes and telephones still have dials, and he's wearing a pair of boots that John Travolta wouldn't be caught in. Is Sam Tyler in a coma? A time warp? 1973 boss is Detective Chief Inspector Gene Hunt. Clearly hasn't heard of sensitivity training.
They reckon you got concussion. Well, I couldn't give a tart's furry cup if half your brains are falling out. Don't ever waltz into my kingdom, acting king of the jungle.
Who the hell are you?
Gene Hunt, you're DCI, and it's 1973, almost dinner time. I'm having oops.
DCI Gene Hunt is played by Philip Glenister. He joins us from London. Mr. Hunt, you see how easy it is to confuse the two of you.
Perfect.
Nice to meet you, Mr. Glenister.
Nice to speak with you. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. Could you do a little translation? For example, what's hoops?
Hoops, well, we still make them, actually, but they're spaghetti hoops, and they're out of a tin.
Pasta, basically, is a very good description. I think we might call those SpaghettiOs in the United
SpaghettiOs.
States.
SpaghettiOs, okay, yeah.
So how do you feel about the confusion between Gene Hunt and yourself?
Well, I've been playing him for a while now because I'm currently doing a sequel to Life on Mars called Ashes to Ashes.
Right.
So I've decided that basically I think he's my alter ego. He gets away with, a huge amount of things that I or anybody else wouldn't be allowed to say, unfortunately, in this day and age. So it's quite joyous just being able to sort of say all the things on behalf of everybody who wants to say those things, you know, which we're not allowed to do now.
But let's play another clip, if we could, where Sam Tyler, the policeman who goes back in time to 1973, is—I don't want to give away too much, but let's just say there's a significant piece of evidence that a judge could use to set somebody who both these policemen are convinced is a deeply bad person and likely to murder again. Here's the confrontation between your character, Gene Hunt, and Sam Tyler.
Look, listen, you told me you were a deputy to the law.
The law is putting bad people away, and you want to show a court that note? Fine. You got principles.
Hang on.
What? You want to have another pop at me? You want to get me suspended? If you like, you can try your hand. And as for this note, I'm making it your call.
It's a very, very gripping sequence, and I don't want to tip off what happens. Mm. But when all is said and done, there's something to be said for DCI Hunt, isn't there?
There's a very, very much a Western element about Life on Mars. You know, there's a spaghetti Western going on. And I think that Gene basically sees himself as the sheriff of his town, and he's there to kick out the bad guys and embrace the good guys. It's just the way he goes about it. There's a particular piece in Life on Mars, which is one of my favourite moments, is when I have a copy of a poster of The Good, the Bad and the Ugly in my office, and Sam walks in while I'm looking at this poster and he says,
"Which one are you?" "All three."
and I kind of think that kind of just sums up the man completely. He's kind of a bit Wyatt Earp, there's a bit of High Noon in there, you know? And that's what I love about the show. It sort of has all these different dimensions to it.
The script writing, as has been noted by many critics, is absolutely fantastic.
Mm.
What's the line, more nervous than a...
More nervous than a small non at a penguin shoot.
Yes.
That's the baby. I know. It's a corker. I don't know how they come up with them, quite frankly.
You were in Calendar Girls with Helen Mirren.
That's right, yeah.
Any funny little stories you want to tell about Dame Helen, who is like the most beloved person in America?
It was quite fun, the sequence I had to shoot, because I was playing the photographer, Lawrence, who obviously has to take the pictures of them all. And it was kind of fun seeing all those ladies of a certain age in the, we call it in this country, the buff, meaning in the nude. And they were incredibly supportive of each other, actually. I did offer to take my clothes off as well, but there was a big silence around the room, which wasn't very encouraging, really. When they had to do their particular setup of the calendar, all of them would be on the studio floor to be there with support, with a few glasses of champagne, I think, just to give them a bit of Dutch courage, so to speak. I wish I'd had more to do in it, really, but as I don't have boobs, it was a bit tricky, really.
I'm sure you've got...
Well, I have man boobs.
I'm sure you've got great ones when all is said and done. But that's
Gene Hunt.
Yeah. I can't believe I said that. And you've been working with Woody Allen?
I have, which was a real treat. I mean, he's one of my sort of all-time heroes, I think. Some of his films have been some of my favourite ever made, really. I have a ritual. I have to watch Love and Death every Christmas. I just love it, and I find it quite Christmassy because of all the Prokofiev music he uses in it, you know. Mm-hmm. But it was great. It's so easy the way, you know, you just see your sides of your scenes, and then he encourages you to just be as naturalistic and feel free to go off the page and ad-lib as much as possible and just stick to the main points and keep those in. And other than that, you're free to do what you like, really, which is terrific. Very enjoyable.
And, of course, you'd be shot if you told us what the movie's about, right? He's pretty...
I don't know. Honestly, I couldn't... I would be shot as well. But also, you don't get to see a full script. And as with most Woody Allen films, there's usually kind of three or four storylines going all on at once. And, you know, he's got an extraordinary cast again. He's got Anthony Hopkins, Frida Pinto from Slumdog Millionaire, Josh Brolin, Antonio Banderas, and me. So I'm sort of involved in Josh Brolin's storyline a little bit, you know, who was also delightful. Real thrill, pleasure to meet.
You have daughters, I believe?
I have two girls, Millie and Charlotte, who are 7 and 4, yeah.
Which raises just about my final question, which is, how would you feel if your daughters met someone like Gene Hunt?
That's a very good question. Do you know what? As long as he acted like me as Gene Hunt, I wouldn't probably mind, actually, because I think overall, actually, I think Gene's a decent guy. I really do. I think he's firm but fair. Just as long as he wasn't the same age as when they met, as long as she's not 17 and he's sort of 50.
Yeah.
Dad, this is my new boyfriend. He's called Gene and he's your age. Oh, good. Oh, good, good, good.
Mr. Glenister, so nice talking to you. Thanks very much.
My pleasure. Lovely to speak to you.
Philip Glenister. He plays Detective Chief Inspector Gene Hunt on the British series Life on Mars, now available on DVD from Acorn Media. He joined us from our studios in London. And to see a clip of DCI Gene Hunt in action, you can go to our blog, npr.org/soapbox. You can also share your memories of 1973.
It's on America's tortured brow that Mickey Mouse...
I'm not sure I can remember 1973. If you'd like to wake up with Philip Glenister, in 1973 you can head to npr.org to watch clips from the show. And this is NPR's Weekend Edition, directed by Elaine Heinzman, produced by Kimberly Adams, Thomas Pierce, Andy Lyman, Eamon Malone, and Julia Holmes-Bailey, along with our interns, Annika Robbins and Sarah Molnar. Our technical director is Burke Hunn, so ably assisted by the Mormon Tabernacle Choir of Engineers. Our reference librarians are Key Molesky, Barbara Van Workham, Katie Doggart, Elizabeth Allen. Melissa Goh is our web producer. Our senior editor is Tony Marcano, and the senior producer of Weekend Edition is Devar Iran Ardalan. And tomorrow, on Weekend Edition Sunday, my friend and colleague Leanne Hansen observes, and the rest of us celebrate her hosting of that program for 20 years. Imagine, she's been hosting a great national radio program from the age of 12. For 20 years, Leanne has managed to be funny, warm, smart, and fascinating at an hour of the day when most of us are lucky just to be able to brush our teeth and count our toes. You know, broadcasting can burn up people. To only get more popular over 20 years is a gift to all of us. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we dig into the pages of the Washington Post magazine, and we hear about a woman who inherited a surprise windfall from a former teacher, a gift that came with no strings attached and no explanation. We'll hear more in a moment. But first, a special mom's conversation with a mom who is also a Grammy Award-winning singer.
I will cross the ocean for you.
Was Monica singing, of course, For You I Will from the 1996 movie Space Jam. Now, you might know her for any number of reasons. Her hit duet with Brandy, The Boy Is Mine, which remains one of the most popular singles in history, according to the Billboard charts, or her guest appearances from such television shows as Living Single or American Dreams. But in her off hours, Monica has a very different life. She is the mother of two young sons. She's trying to keep her relationship strong with her partner and the father of her boys, rapper Rodney Rocco Hill Jr., as well as produce a fifth album. And now she's bringing her fans into all of her worlds as the star of a new reality show airing on BET called Still Standing. And Monica is with us now from Atlanta. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You know, it seems that reality shows have become quite the thing these days. Did you have any hesitation about doing it?
Actually, I just flat out said no in the beginning. I thought if my life wasn't very dramatic with drama-filled situations all the time, that it wouldn't be interesting. So after we talked, and only after James Dubose and I talked, I realized that they were looking for a show that was about a person that had experienced a lot.
James Dubose being the producer of both the album and the program.
He's the producer of the television show. He created a lot of other shows. But I just didn't want people to be hung up on the different tests and trials. And then he explained, no, I've seen you on different occasions, and I see the way that you are with your children. I see the way that you are about your work, you know, and the fact that you started at 12 years old, you know, makes me feel like there's a lot to the story that people don't know. And the great part about the show for me, he understood a lot of the ways that I felt and my views, and me being so solely based on my faith, everything, the foundation of everything that I do is my faith. So when we started talking, you know, the comfortability just came after that.
Well, let's talk about some of the things that you have going on now, because as I mentioned, one of the things that's interesting that I think will be interesting to a lot of people about this series is that you are a working mom, but you happen to work in a particular field, okay,
right,
which is music. It's kind of a critical time in your career. This is your fifth album that you're putting together, and it hasn't been the easiest time. I mean, you've had some, you know, monster hits in the 90s, but subsequently things haven't always been as smooth, in part because, as comes clear in the series, you haven't always felt that you've been showcased in the way that you want to be. I just want to play a short clip from the series where you're talking to your producer about what you're trying to accomplish with this album, and here it is.
What was that?
That was the joint I was talking about.
Do you really feel like that record sounded like me? I don't. It's like, I almost thought you might have been playing something on somebody else that you just needed to, like, listen to for a hot minute, because I know you didn't think that I need to record that song.
Tell me more about that. Was that a difficult conversation to have,
when
particularly
I get angry
in front of other people?
You know what it is? Each of my albums have been great examples of where I was at that particular time. On the fourth album, we released a single. The label felt that it was the right song for me, and myself and the producer of the song, which was Jermaine Dupri, said no. And that album, The Makings of Me, my very last one, it did not sell like the other ones. So the passion that you hear, it's not that I don't respect the producers, but they can go on and produce hit after hit, or one may not work, they can move on. It doesn't have the same effect on a producer as it does an artist. But what I did recognize is that I should not record songs that aren't true to who I am, because if they do become singles, if they do get out to the masses, and that is not what the audience that has supported me for almost 15 years wants, then you suffer the consequences. And that's what happened the last time.
Let's talk about the kids for a minute, if we can. You're the proud mom of two young boys. Very adorable. And I just want to play a short clip of you talking about them.
No matter what I got going on, That's not my children's issue. Being a mom is my greatest accomplishment yet. I've never felt the kind of love that I felt after having my children. But my two sons, Rocco, Romello, I experienced it. And it's scary, but it feels real, real good.
Talk to me about that. What's scary?
Well, when I say scary, I mean it's scary that you can love someone more than you love yourself, or love them so much that you'll sacrifice anything that you can for them. You know, that's scary when you think about it, you know, because your children do need that. They need your unconditional love. But sometimes I have to say, okay, Mom, chill out. He's at school. Give it a rest. You know, I have to kind of check myself sometimes because it's just a natural thing for me. My mom was always very, very loving, very affectionate, compassionate. So I wanted to be that way with my children, but I'm also a lot more protective because I experienced more than she did. She grew up in the country with a lot of siblings where things happen in a very structured way. I grew up in the city where peer pressure, death, danger was all around.
You alerted earlier to some of the things that you've gone through in your life, in addition to the hits that many people will remember and know about. Some people will also remember that you went through a very difficult period back in the year 2000 when your then boyfriend killed himself in your presence. And I think a lot of people would just like to know how you recovered from that.
You know, God is so awesome. And as I think about the things that happened in my life, especially that particular incident, it was the love of my family. And it was them reminding me that, yeah, at a lot of points in your life, you've strayed from what you've known, and what you've known is the right thing. And he's forgiven. He's so awesome that he gives you a second, a third, a fourth, and fifth chance. But you have to develop your own relationship with Christ again. And that was something that my mom used to always tell me. Find a quiet place where you can speak to God and just recreate your own relationship with him. And that's what I would do. And I say about 6 to 8 weeks after the incident, I started feeling his presence taking over me. You know, and I would suggest to anybody to have some type of spirituality that they can cling to and find some type of solace when things just get really rough.
I wanted to ask, though, about a couple more things, if you have a couple more minutes for us. This whole
Absolutely.
Question of how you balance being a mom with the demands of a career in which your sexiness is often the draw. But I know that you're in a field where sometimes women feel as they get older, as they take on more family responsibilities, particularly if they're very protective of their family time, feel that they're at a disadvantage. Do you ever feel that way? And what's your plan? How are you going to handle that?
You know, I told them, I explained to everybody around me from the television show when we went in. I say this, I said it when I went in to work on my new deal for my new album. My kids come first. People have made the accommodations because I think people do respect family. You know, when you say the reasoning for why things are that way, you know, it's mandatory that I'm in places that have kitchens. The kitchen is not for me. The kitchen is because I still fix my kids' meals. You know, and I think people can appreciate it because they know it's not some diva attitude or some unnecessary stuff that I need. You know, they see the boys, they're 4-1. So they still have certain requirements, you know, on a regular basis.
What about marriage? Do you think that might
marriage
be part
is
of your
gonna
future?
Happen very soon?
Really?
Absolutely. 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 You know, it was something I did it very differently than most women. I've never, ever mentioned the word marriage to him. I let him mention it to me. And
him being
Rodney, my fiance.
Who's the father of
yes.
your boys?
We've known each other for 9 years, so we're very comfortable with one another in ways that are hard to sometimes even explain because we were only 19 when we met. So as we went into our relationship and our first son was born, I was 24 years old, and, you know, he said something about us getting married then, you know, and then once our second son was born, 2.5 years later, he just told me, you know, this is what I want for us. This is what I want for our family. And of course, you know, by me reading the word, we know that that was not the proper order. And we recognize that. And God has forgiven us. And we both moved on from it. So us looking to being married is something that I'm really excited about.
Monica is the star of a new docudrama, reality program, whatever you want to call it. It airs on BET. It's called Still Standing. That is also the title of her new album, which is expected in January. And Monica was kind enough to join us from her home base in Atlanta. Monica, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
We're going to check in this morning on the fortunes of one of the big broadcast networks. NBC put the Jay Leno show on the air 5 nights a week at 10 o'clock in the evening, a much-hyped move that doesn't seem to be working, at least not now. Entertainment reporter Kim Masters has been following this NBC drama from her perch in Los Angeles. Hi, Kim.
Hi, Steve.
And, of course, the whole point was not to pay for a drama, but to pay for something cheaper. And why isn't it working?
Well, people are not, you know, watching. That is, you know, it's good to be cheap, but if you have no ratings or very low ratings, that doesn't work. Now, at this point, Leno has lost to a cable show, which is not the norm for a broadcast network. He lost to Sons of Anarchy on FX. And last week, he lost to a rerun on CBS, a rerun of CSI Miami. And that is not good because they've argued that he will be very strong against reruns, and now he's already in the early stages been beaten by a rerun.
Now, I'm remembering that with the broadcast networks, the 10 o'clock programming is really important for the local station because they want something strong that delivers a bunch of viewers to their local 11 o'clock news. Are the local stations suffering here?
The local stations are suffering badly, including, you know, ones that NBC owns. New York down 22% in the newscast. Philadelphia down 37%. Miami down 30%. So as you can tell, the effect has not been good. And it also has not been good on, you know, Conan O'Brien, after the news, is doing much worse than Leno did in that slot. Jimmy Fallon, after Conan, is doing worse than Conan used to do in that slot. It's having a negative effect on the NBC schedule.
Now, we should mention that Jay Leno has been in ratings trouble before and pulled out of it. What's he doing to respond to this?
He just gave an interview to a trade publication, Broadcasting and Cable, and it was kind of a combination of trying to show that he can take it and that he would be just as happy to return to his old slot should that occur. One of his quotes, "What am I supposed to do, sit here and whine? Emotionally, I can take body shots all day long." But he is willing to return to 11:35 should the television gods decree it.
Is that an option?
Well, of course it's an option. They'd have to pay Conan a lot of money. But NBC right now is sort of, they're kind of in denial. They're saying this is great. They are not admitting that this is not working. And I think we will need to see some big changes at the top before anybody addresses the situation.
What's it mean that NBC is having this ratings disaster? Not just one night a week, but 5 nights a week in prime time, just as the parent company, General Electric, is trying to sell NBC Universal.
Well, I think the potential buyer here is Comcast, the big cable operator, and they are not naive about the television business. They are smart guys. I think they understand what their problems are going to be if they acquire this company. And, you know, they're looking at a bigger picture. NBC is part of NBC Universal. That includes a film studio, Universal Studios, which is also troubled right now, but nonetheless one of the few remaining major film studios. And it includes the jewels in the crown, these cable channels like USA and Bravo. There has been some thought, will they make NBC into a cable channel? Is the broadcast model so broken that it's not worth trying to salvage NBC? I don't think it's there yet. Broadcast is still the biggest aggregator of eyeballs. And I think that should Comcast acquire this company, which feels, you know the word beshert, Steve?
It feels, no, I don't.
Beshert is a Yiddish word. It means meant to be. It feels very much like this Comcast acquisition of NBC Universal is going to happen. There are a lot of little issues along the way, but it feels that Comcast has wanted to be in the content business for a long time. GE needs and wants to get out of this business. And I think if Comcast does make this deal, they'll roll up their sleeves and they will try to fix things at NBC.
Kim Masters was beshert to be on Morning Edition this morning. Kim, thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
She hosts member station KCRW show, The Business.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Elizabeth Taylor is without a doubt one of Hollywood's all-time leading ladies.
We must not disappoint the mighty Caesar. The Romans tell fabulous tales of my bath and handmaidens. And my morals?
Taylor's larger-than-life celebrity has just as much to do with her dramas off the screen, her multiple marriages, her diamond collecting, her yo-yo dieting. A new biography is aptly called How to Be a Movie Star, and the author William Mann sat down with me recently. He says Elizabeth Taylor's formula for success was simple. She knew what she had, she knew how to use it, and just when people were ready to cast her as a has-been, she knew how to reinvent herself. Oh, and one other thing. William Mann says Taylor mastered the well-timed malady.
The classic case is the one in London when she had pneumonia and she had a tracheotomy. It was very real. There was the scar on her throat to prove that she had a tracheotomy. But what her people around her, her agents and her managers, with her compliance, did was they used that to keep the interest in her alive. And so in this case, there were hourly bulletins issued from the hospital, and publicists rounded up people to gather in the streets so that we suddenly had this mob surrounding the hospital waiting for word on Elizabeth Taylor. Suddenly a rumor spreads that she may have died, and the whole world is waiting, you know, on tiptoes to find out what happened to Elizabeth. And of course, she emerged fine the next day with a new hairdo, and they were really playing not just to the world audience, but they were playing to a very specific audience in Los Angeles, the Academy voters who were voting on Best Actress. And no surprise, Elizabeth won for Butterfield 8 that year.
Let's see what we can learn about Elizabeth Taylor from looking at a few of her big movies. Mm-hmm. Cleopatra, where her divadom, if I can make up a word there, was on full display.
Right.
She was amazingly demanding. And mm-hmm. the thing that jumped out to me is this demand that she have a different cigarette holder for each cigarette, and it could not clash with anything around her.
They were all color-coordinated with her outfits as well as the tablecloth for the dinner that evening. You know, part of it was Elizabeth always loved living large, and it served her very well because I think the public loved those kinds of stories because it fit. You know, this was her image. She was the woman swathed in mink and ermine and dripping with diamonds and emeralds, and that was her image, and it really wasn't born out of any arrogance. It was coming from a sense of this is how a movie star lives.
Elizabeth Taylor played a series of on-screen sirens in Suddenly Last Summer and Butterfield 8 and Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. And these films were made at a moment when Hollywood was at a real crossroads in terms of dealing with sexual content on screen. How much did she personally push the envelope?
She was always pushing the envelope ever since she was a young girl. She started off very naive, very innocent during her first marriage to Nicky Hilton, who was the great-granduncle of Paris Hilton. That marriage woke her up, and she realized, wow, you know, there's a real world outside of the MGM lot. And then she became very sophisticated in terms of sex and in terms of relationships, not only in her films, but also in her personal life. When she fell in love with Richard Burton in Rome, you know, 10 years earlier, Ingrid Bergman had been banished for having a child with a man to whom she was not married. Here's Elizabeth Taylor married to Eddie Fisher. Here's Richard Burton married to his wife. And they begin this affair very publicly. Rather than apologize for this, she stood up and honestly said, this is what happens. Life sometimes is messy. We're sorry if we've hurt anybody, but we can't deny the fact that we're in love. And instead of pushing the public away, I think it nudged them along a little bit in their own understanding of sex and relationships.
I want to ask you about Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, the film. One of the things that stands out in reading about the filming is that Elizabeth Taylor was a much more precise and accomplished actress than she's often given credit for.
When she had the right director, when she had good material, she could more than rise to the occasion. It happened with George Stevens during A Place in the Sun when she was only 17 years old. It happened again with Stevens during Giant. It happened with Richard Brooks with Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. And it certainly happened with Mike Nichols on Virginia Woolf.
You see, George didn't have much push. He wasn't particularly aggressive. In fact, he was sort of a flop. A great, big, fat flop.
Stop it, Mother.
I hope that was an empty bottle, George. You can't afford to waste good liquor. Not on your salary, not on an associate professor's salary.
She just really explodes on the screen. And what's so extraordinary about her performance in Virginia Woolf is that Martha, her character, she's loud and she's vulgar and she's crass and she's mean and she's cruel, but she's also sympathetic. We never dislike her. We get frustrated with her, but we also have great compassion for her. And that's remarkable acting. You know, that's a remarkable achievement for a woman who had never had an acting class.
One scene that you actually describe, it's actually multiple takes. In the third take, where she has to go and get made up again and have this breakdown on film where she's crying and really sort of falling apart before the cameras, at a key moment, she pauses and someone snores
it's
up above her.
It's a wonderful story and really kind of gives the insight into her heart and soul. She had been so worried about this scene. There was a series of technical glitches where they had to stop and do it over again. Finally, on this scene where she was just magnificent, this stagehand above in one of the rafters starts snoring. And, you know, there's nothing Mike Nichols can do except call cut. And right on top of his word cut, he said, Elizabeth was saying to him, don't fire him, don't fire him. And, you know, she identified with these, you know, blue-collar workers who were working there. They had been her family ever since she'd been a little girl, you know, all of the technicians on the set. So she didn't want this poor guy fired. And yet, when she did the scene again, Nichols said she was fantastic.
And Nichols did not fire him.
No, he did not fire him, you're right.
It's clear that you have great affection for this actress. What do you say to the critics who are already saying that you've dealt with her with a gloved hand, that you have seemed to be almost intoxicated by some of the fairy dust that surrounded her life?
Well, yes, and they said I fall in love with my subject. I think in some ways you have to fall in love with your subject if you're really going to get inside them. There are lots of things that I would say are in the book that are critical, that look at the pettiness, perhaps, of stardom, the smallness of stardom. But for me, when I look at my subject, I try to balance. Is this someone that I admire? Is this someone that I respect? Or is this someone that, you know, is lacking in some of those qualities? I think Elizabeth really deserves a lot of that respect and accolades. But I think there were moments where I certainly was critical of her her narcissism as well.
How's she doing now?
She, you know, she just had heart surgery, and she, you know, tweeted that she feels like she has a new ticker.
Hold on. You used an important verb there, because this is one of the things that I found so fascinating.
Right.
She tweets.
She tweets.
She's on Twitter all the time.
She is indeed. The people around her are brilliant. They know how to keep her name in the public. And so she's actually been tweeting. You know, here I am going into the operating room. Here I am coming out of the operating room, you know.
But there are also strange things. Like today I'm enjoying brie on a baguette.
And she probably is. And by doing that, you know, she gets people talking about her, which is, after all, is the whole point of the game.
The book is called How to Be a Movie Star, Elizabeth Taylor in Hollywood. The author is William Mann. William, thank you very much.
Thank you.